This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
City Limits, brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment,
to transport and planning and housing issues,
to privatisations and our utility services,
to building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Okay, City Limits, and it's a fourth Wednesday of the month, in fact, so we've got no specific subject today, but in fact, for that reason, we're going to have a long chat to David Spratt, who's a well-known, I think not just in Australia now, but worldwide expert on climate change issues. David, of course, way back in, I think it was 2008, he can correct us if he wants to, he wrote a book called Climate Change Code Red, warning then that urgent action was needed, and I think the thrust of today will be as usual that the urgent action wasn't heeded. We're also going to talk about issues like the impact of AI now, that rather than go backwards on energy and use of electricity and fossils, we're going the other way. So chat to David today. Now, Koshin has come on the show today. He's sitting there. He's part of another Wednesday program, which is a very radical program, in fact. I mean, the name says itself, Koshin, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. Sure does. It's Uprise Radio.
Uprise Radio. I mean, it's just disgusting. but anyway, Koshin drew the short straw today, so he's pressing buttons for us. Cup of tea, by the way. Want a cup of tea?
Sure, yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, it's a Vietnamese green tea today, if you're interested in what you're getting. Comes in little globules, and then it breaks up into, we know this sort of tea, it breaks up into strands. Now, you've got a choice of a plain white cover or Don't Be a Mug, Join the Union Today mug.
Oh, if I can get the Don't
Union?
Be a Mug, yeah, that'd
yeah,
be great.
Yeah, right, okay. Right,
thanks
there
so
you
much.
Are.
Yes.
Okay, so you're not a mug, I'm the mug with the white mug. Now, your first test on the program, though, is going to be a tough one, so sit back and, there was a headline in the Financial Review last Thursday on the features page, and it's asked a question. Don't put it as a question, but I ask you as a question whether you think this, in fact, will be the case.
Okay.
Tough one for you, but
right.
I don't know how long you're going to need to think about this. Albanese versus Taylor could be, wait for it, socialism versus capitalism.
Yeah.
Now, could it be?
Could be. It's which team's which? I'm not sure.
Ah, now that might be the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, I've always liked how Labor appears in the Financial Review. Makes them seem. I wish they were how they appeared in that newspaper.
Yeah, that's right. Well, anyway, it could be, but I think it won't be. I got a vague feeling, and I think amid all of Donald Trump's wonderful performances this week, as usual, he's now sending a hospital boat to Greenland to treat the many sick people in Greenland. He didn't provide any details or the number of people he was seeing, but he's sending a great hospital, he called it a great hospital boat to Greenland to take care of the many people who are sick and not being taken care of there. Isn't that wonderful of him?
That's really nice. Yeah,
yes.
It's generous.
Yes. Now, subsequent to this particular item, it's called the USNS Mercy, by the way. It's a great name for it, isn't it, Mercy? Anyway, the only problem that occurred subsequently was that Donald forgot to check whether the Mercy was actually able to be taken there, and it wasn't because it's in dry dock somewhere getting fixed and it won't be available for months. But minor problem.
Yeah, no, it shouldn't be a big deal. I struggled to believe that he would say something that wasn't true, that he's not going to follow through on.
Oh, you're not suggesting he ever tells anything that isn't true, do you? I mean,
No. I would think, though, if he's going to give free medical assistance, I would think that, from what I understand about the citizens in America, that they might like that. Yeah.
Maybe the Mersey should be cruising all over America on the behind a truck. And we have to give full marks to the Centerview Partners, which is a banking establishment in the United States. It had hired a young woman called Catherine Sheba as an analyst, and she's apparently quite good at it, and she was quite thrilled to get the job, and she was a coveted spot. The only problem is that they expect people to work 24 hours a day, and she said she has a health condition, in her case, that requires her to get at least 8 hours sleep a night. So she requested that, and they allowed her to have time off between midnight and 9 a.m., which is incredibly generous when you think about it, isn't it? I mean, and to go home at night. I mean, workers going home at night seems to be, you know, outrageous, doesn't it? They just want more wages and conditions all the time, don't they? Anyway, then they told her that this wasn't a goer, and because they said should have known the job's unpredictable hours and took a coveted spot that Centerview could have offered to someone else. And anyway, they gave her the flick because of this, because she wouldn't work the 24 hours a day. And as a result of Sheba's need to sign offline at midnight each night, Sheba's colleagues were left picking up on work streams that Sheba would have been responsible for completing. Centerview ultimately added a new analyst to that deal team on account of these issues, uncommon in Centerview's, quote, lean staffing structure, so they try to... Maybe if they employed more people, the individuals wouldn't have to work 24 hours a day. That's a thought.
Yeah. Maybe a bit too lean.
It's just a thought, no, it wouldn't be too lean because come on. She took them to court, which was rather awful of her, and it was settled. They don't know what it was settled for, but she was chasing $7 million in Australian terms in damages, but it has been settled. They say they would have won in court, but it was easy to get it out of the way by doing this. But what a generous company. But the article, in fact, points out that, in fact, it's common in that industry for workers. And in fact, the demanding hours expected at Wall Street firms have been long controversial. The 2024 deaths of two young Bank of America employees sparked widespread discussions about possible overwork, though it was not clear whether that was a factor. I'm sure it was. Since then, some of the biggest banks have sought to limit junior bankers' workloads up to a point. JP Morgan in 2024 capped work at 80 hours a week. Wow, I mean, all that free time. While Bank of America launched a new internal platform to monitor whether employees were staying within their 100-hour weekly limits. So if you're thinking of a job, there's a place. Yeah.
I like that they say that it's common, as if that's, you know, that makes it okay, as long as it's common.
That's right. Of course. Well, it is. Sky News. It was, of course, it's one of Murdoch's great outlets, in which you get the deep thoughts of people like Andrew Bolt Peter Credlin, those sort of people who you know, really know what's going on in this world.
Intellectual titans.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's if you want the news, that's where you go. Of course, it is free in the bush. You've got to pay in town, but if you're in the bush or friends of mine in the bush, watch it and ring up and sort of carry on about what they just saw these people say. They've had to change their name because, in fact, it's registered in Britain, and they had an agreement to use it for X number of years, but that license has run out. So they're now changing their name to News 24.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a good name, isn't it? News 24, because they're News Limited, of course, so that's okay, yeah. And it should be great. They had a big launch last week, and really important people were there. Koshin, did you get an invite, speaking of really important people being there?
I did not get invited to the rename party, no.
No, well, you would have enjoyed yourself chatting to all the big people there, by the way. It would have been fun talking to Angus and... all of them, and even that wonderful Peter Volandis was there, you know, Peter who runs soccer and footy and everything else and racing in New South Wales. He, lovely bloke. They were all there, so anyway, you missed out, but there's new now, so now it's News 24 giving us the same wonderful news. Now, we mentioned last week how since they'd registered the Land Registry Office, I'm sorry, privatised the Land Registry Office, hard as it is to believe with privatisation, the cost of using it has risen substantially, which bit of a shock, I would have thought. They also privatised the Ravenhall prison, and it's supposed to be a fine example of how people go there and never go back in again. Well, unfortunately, it turns out the reincarceration rate is no better or worse. In fact, it's slightly worse than other prisons where they haven't got this program being run by the fabulous private company which runs the prison at a massive expense. In fact, it costs $600 a day for each prisoner to go through the program and go back to prison again, which is pretty good. So it's another example, unfortunately, of maybe privatisation not working as well as it could. And it turns out that it may be also they're going back because they're not actually getting the very program that the privatisation, when it was signed up, was supposed to do, and that's not being monitored by government. So just a bit of a problem, isn't it, how you can sort these things out. But one answer is because of the new bail laws, of course, more and more people are being on remand. In fact, there's an extraordinary figure. I think it's something like 39 or something percent of prisoners at the moment locked up are on remand, which means they haven't actually been found guilty of anything, but they're locked up thanks to the government. But while we can't afford to build public housing, we can afford to build new prisons, which is the same sort of thing because it puts a roof over people's heads. So,
Yeah, you'd think that they would learn at this point about the private prison system. If only there was some kind of a lesson that we could learn and, you know, maybe realize that it's not good to financially incentivize having people in prison. It's a bad feedback loop to have.
Yep, but there was an implication in what you just said that maybe they haven't learned the lesson.
No, yeah, it seems like it.
Good heavens. Now, even the a mob called the E61 Institute, which is sort of a middle-of-the-road type economic mob, they suggest that maybe one of the reasons we're getting blooming deficits in this country and the capitalists are carrying on about it, which doesn't worry me too much. I mean, the government goes into debt, that's good because it's probably building things or doing things, and they're upset about the number of public servants because they're replacing the consultants they used to spend millions on, so it's all very good. But this report suggests that we're not taxing people enough, and I think they mean capitalists, which is a bit of a problem. It's okay for workers to pay tax, but for God's sake, what happens to the shareholders? What happens to investment if you tax corporates?
Yeah, what's going to be left to trickle down if it's all getting taxed?
Well, yeah, that's very important. And in fact, on that very theme, Bill Keltie, of course, made a submission to this parliamentary inquiry this week looking at these issues. And Bill suggested this is going into the capital gains tax that the government's thinking of maybe changing a little bit so you don't give quite so much to the super rich. Bill Keltie said they should learn from the Hawke Keating years, and that's the solution to it. And of course, Hawke Keating and Keltie were so instrumental in Australia in bringing neoliberal capitalism to us, which has worked wonders. And Bill tells us that it's worked wonders.
Yeah.
Just hasn't been that good for the working class that they said it was all about. But there you are.
It's okay. We just need to privatise a little bit more, and then we'll hit that tipping point.
And then, and the trickle down will really work.
Then that'll open the floodgates. Yeah.
I always regard the trickle down as being little globules of yellow liquid.
Yeah, it feels like that.
But maybe I'm wrong. But there you are. But Bill's got it all sorted out. But in fact, there was another interesting article I read recently that said that the Liberal Party is in fact starting to realise that neoliberal capitalism hasn't worked and it's moving away from it, and the Labour Party has now become the biggest defender of neoliberal capitalism. Mm. I mentioned last week, I think I said it on air to a guest, because, or maybe to a listener who'd sent me some information and said something, and I pointed out to him, if he hadn't read it, you probably have, Koshin, Elizabeth Humphrey's book about, it's called How Labour Brought Neoliberal Capitalism. She's a Sydney academic, yeah.
No, I have to confess I have not read it, but yeah, I'll get on it.
Well, Billy Kelty does get a mention in the book a few times, actually, just to mention it, yeah. But it's quite a good description of Labour at that time, you know, falling for the whole box and dice. And, and of course, in the course of it, destroying the trade union movement to a great degree and all that, yeah. This is good news, because we say, you know, governments aren't spending enough on things that matter. Well, they're about to spend even more on things that matter. They've just set aside another $1 billion fund to tap the venture capital market for investments in high-tech military hardware. Now, that's what we need badly.
Definitely.
I mean, forget hospitals and forget public transport and forget housing and forget education and forget social welfare. This is all we need. And we're responding to a bloke called Eli Raymer, who was Assistant Secretary of Defence for the Indo-Pacific under Joe Biden. He's been in Australia telling us we need to spend heaps and heaps more. And in fact, America knows that, which is really important to know. He said, I think that's a bipartisan sentiment in Washington. Obviously, the way that it's communicated and some of the tactics may be different, but this is not a Trump administration fixation that's likely to go away. We feel Australia must spend more on military expenditure. So that means military expenditure, presumably to the American merchants of death, of course, or the United States merchants of death.
Yeah.
So that's good. And the capabilities that could receive funding include emerging technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum, and undersea warfare. Now, the undersea warfare one's interesting, because they're really developing these drones and things that can get around. Mm. So it starts to make you question that the nuclear subs we're not going to get what we're paying for, whether we need them anyway, because probably by that time everyone will have something that can wipe them out in about 10 seconds.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It does feel like that. It feels like we're throwing money into floppy disks right when the CD gets invented.
I'm going to top up. Do you want a bit of top up tea, or you're right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Here we go.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, sorry, listen, we're just having a bit of a tea top up while we're doing all this. There we are. So that's it. So we're $1 billion set aside. But it's $1 billion to prop up industry, so we're actually going to give it to the private sector, the merchants of death who make fortunes, to make more fortunes with our money, at the same time as we're also, of course, giving billions to the US and Britain to build submarines we're never going to see.
Yeah.
It's not a bad system.
It's a good racket they've got going. It's good that it's comforting to know that it's a bipartisan consensus in Washington that that Australia should pump billions into
that's right.
the US weapons defense. Yeah,
they all believe we should give them money.
It's good to know that they won't be debating that too much.
Yeah, great to see a bit of bipartisanship in America. Now, Richard Miles, of course, is that giant mind who is the minister for train killing here in Australia. It turns out he is an America, or not America, because America's not just America. America's all over the place, Canada and right down to South America and Latin America, but the United States part of America. Apparently he's a United States file. It turns out someone discovered that his fetish for America is strewn across his ministerial office in Geelong. It's full of US memorabilia, including that he's been made a colonel of Kentucky. Isn't that wonderful?
Interesting. Okay.
Yes. And he's got a certificate with the designation Kentucky Colonel, dated 2003 and signed by former Kentucky Governor Paul Patton. It's also made out to the Honourable Richard Miles, despite him not being an MP in 23. He was a senior official at the ACTU. So how, and well, this is an article in a column that sort of does these sort of things. So how and why did Miles get so on the radar of the Kentuckian top brass that he picked up the state's top honorary title? His office didn't come forward with an explanation. Little Richard did write about Kentucky's right to work laws for the ACTU in 04, but the title is one bestowed by the state's executive, and past recipients include Muhammad Ali, Winston Churchill, and Harlan Sanders of chicken fame. Another familiar face did get it recently. Cardboard King Anthony Pratt was given the title by current Governor Andy Beshear in 23. He was so enamoured, Pratt calls himself the Colonel on LinkedIn. But Pratt at least poured billions into the state. What could a low-level union official from Geelong possibly have done to get it? Consider us intrigued.
Yeah, that is interesting. I hadn't heard about that, yeah. No, it's... It's good to know that he's, you know, he's obsessing about the US. It's good to know that he's draping himself in memorabilia.
But the prospect, therefore, of Miles taking on the US in terms of pouring more and more money into the defence and merchants of death is therefore not on. I mean, he's just going to keep giving them more and more money.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, you know, from that point of view, it's highly dangerous in terms of our finances anyway, yeah. Look, we'll take a break now. It's 9:21, and we'll get David Spratt on the line, and we'll talk some sense on this program.
Great.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Huelga compañero, no vayas a trabajar. Deja quieta la herramienta, que es la hora de luchar. A la huelga, yes, a la huelga, 100. A la huelga, madre, la voy también. A la huelga, 100, a la huelga, 1000. Yo por ellos, madre, ellos por mí. Contra el gobierno del hambre nos vamos a levantar, todos los trabajadores codo a codo con el pan. A la huelga, yes, a la huelga, 100, a la huelga, madre, la voy también. A la huelga, 100, a la huelga, 1000, yo por ellos, madre, ellos por mí. Del pozo y el arrado, desde otoño el terrar, vivan los hombres del pueblo, a la huelga federal. A la huelga, yes, a la huelga, 100, a la huelga, madre, la voy también. A la huelga, 100, a la huelga, 1000, yo por ellos, madre, ellos por mí. Todo todos los pueblos del mundo la mano nos la van a dar para devolver a España su perdida libertad. A la huelga 100, a la huelga de la voy también, a la huelga 100, a la huelga 1000, yo por ellos, madre, ellos por mí.
Great. Okay, you going to back announce that?
That was Aloega by, I did not write it down, from the Breadline.
Ah, that's a strange name, did not write it down. That's an interesting name for a band, I suppose. On the line, we have got David Spratt, who's a climate activist. And I was thinking in saying, calling you a climate activist, Dave, I suppose we could also call the heads of fossil companies climate activists, because they're doing a fair bit to stuff up the climate.
Well, indeed.
Indeed. Of course, I said earlier that way back, I think it was 2008, but I'll stand corrected, you published Climate Change Code Red, warning then that we needed to act very rapidly, and yet all these years later, they haven't.
No, I mean, it was 2008, and your memory's good, Kevin. I mean, I do remember in 2010, I think the predecessor of the Climate Council, Will Steffen, said that 2010 to 2020 was the critical decade. You know, we really had to reduce emissions between in those 10 years. And then we get to 2020 and they call 2020 the critical decade. So I think we're probably post-critical now.
Yes. Well, in fact, there was an article recently based on the official files coming out at New Year that Trump had been, Howard had been warned way back then about the same time. That he needed to act urgently, and all the things that were going to happen, and subsequently a couple of climate change activists did say that in fact they're worse than they were predicting then, which I think we know because it's becoming almost exponential. And yet Howard, of course, did not act. He went the other way.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, people who know me well might know that I've done a lot of work with a guy called Ian Dunlop, who was a former risk management manager for Shell, but a good guy, and came over to our side, and he'd been very vocal, and he stood for the BHP board to try and knock off the directors. Didn't work, but he has really understood what's going on for a long time. He said in the 1980s, he was part of a group of executives across the oil companies who were just sitting down. Their job was to understand future climate change. And in fact, in the early 2000s, Ian was appointed by John Howard to chair his first emissions trading task force. And that was driven by Robert Hill, the Environment Minister, who seemed to get it. And so there was some interest in doing something about it. But, of course, when it got to Cabinet, it got killed off. So, I mean, I know from the inside that there was an understanding back then.
Yeah, I mean, Howard wouldn't even ratify the Kyoto Protocol back then, which is, you know,
and the only thing that got him slightly anxious and worried was the 2006-07 drought, which was so bad that he felt he had to do something. By then it was too late and he was, you know, ready to walk the plank.
Yeah, a bit too late though, yeah. sadly. Also, I was going to open with a very sad note. I'm sure we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when we also spoke to an anti-gas activist, but you must be pretty upset that we're losing Meg O'Neill from Woodside, who's resigned. He's one of our very favourite people.
Kevin, my fear is there's an endless supply of people like her.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
you know what I mean. I mean, you think, oh, God, the next one can't be as bad as the last one. And whether it comes to prime ministers or whatever, there seems to be an endless number in the stack. I mean, it's not about the individuals. It's about these companies. And, you know, Woodside, we know, got permissions from the Labor government to expand its Northwest Shelf interest, which will become the second single biggest polluter in Australia. So her job is done. But I was just looking at what's happened during the time of the Albanese government. And in their first term, between 2022 and 2025, the Albanese government authorised 27 new coal, oil and gas projects. 27. Mm-hmm. And since May of last year, they've added another 8 on, including the Woodside project, and there are another 42 lining up seeking approval. So it's not just the Meg O'Neill problem, it's the Canberra problem.
And all the other companies, the Santoses and the Chevrons and a lot of them,
of course.
Of course, there was a, in fact, just this week on Monday in the Age, an article that that showed that the Age got it, I think, through Freedom of Information, that Woods about Woodside, in fact, almost demanding that the Watts chain, that's the minister, of course, change the conditions he was going to put on the Northwest Gas Shelf project. And, you know, they made massive changes, and it's almost the wording from Woodside is almost demanding that they change them and that they can't possibly meet these particular conditions, etc. But it, they were watered down very much from the original, so that they end up being pretty well meaningless.
Well, I mean, Tanya Plibersek wasn't a great minister, but, I mean, she was placed by Murray Watt for a reason. And he's just a head kicker with the skin of a crocodile who will just go in and back to the fossil fuel industry. And that's what he's put in for, and that's what he's done. And that's not surprising. I mean, if you look at the gas industry in particular and its lobbyists, you will find every second person who's ever been in a Labor cabinet or national secretary or higher up apparatus in the Labor Party is a paid lobbyist for the gas industry. I mean, former senior ministers, treasurers, several former minerals and energy ministers. So, I mean, the disease is inside the Labor Party. It's not just the gas industry leaning on the Labor Party.
No, Martin Ferguson, in fact, was mentioned on the Brekkie Show this morning because he was at a conference about putting a head in the sand.
And he's not alone. I mean, there are 20 people like him.
Yeah, interesting that was Monday. Of course, Murray Watt bounced also off having sacked sacked the construction union. Then he moved across to sacking or getting rid of some of the oldest rock art in the world.
Well, I mean, you know, Kevin, you worked for Labor MP way back in your youth. I mean, there was a term, and it was somebody who was a Labor head kicker, and I'd say he fits that term perfectly.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, very much so.
I mean, he evidence and right and wrong has got nothing to do with the decisions that are made.
In fact, the same day, that was The Age on Monday, had that article about Woodside lobbying the government, not just lobbying the government, almost ordering what to do, what he did. And the same day, the Financial Review had an article that Rio Tinto's top Australian executive personally lobbied Jim Chalmers to maintain the $11 billion fuel tax rebate scheme in the May budget, arguing the mining truck fleet will not be electrified for years. And they just couldn't do it because it's too costly. She argued the pathways needed for the mining industry to decarbonise were technologically immature or are fundamentally constrained by electricity availability. Could you explain that to me?
That's bullshit. I mean, honestly...
right, that explains it.
Sorry. I mean, if you look at what Andrew Twiggy Forrest has done with Fortescue, I mean, and he really does get climate change. If anybody's ever seen his climate presentations, I think he's one of the few elite people in Australia who really understands it. And he is trying to prosecute the case in terms of electrifying his whole operation and his trains and so on, and he's doing it. He's spending money. He's doing it. So that claim is that the mining companies doesn't want to spend the money. I mean, there are no technological barriers to doing what they want to do because Fortescue is already doing it.
And of course, it's capitalism. The capitalists who are screaming and herring on about government expenditure being too high. But the fuel tax credits, according to this, are one of the 20 most expensive items in the government's budget.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it is obscene. I'm sure this has been said in your program many times before. It is obscene that we basically don't tax the production of fossil fuel exports in Australia in any way near the way, for example, Norway does. So we don't tax it, and then we give them a subsidy as well. So I mean, there's a double whammy to the budget there.
So, well, when they talk about, there were ads in the paper recently where they're saying the resource industry funds as Medibank or some silly thing. Well, the Australian Institute has pointed out that in fact students paying their HECSA pay more than the fuel than their industry. But anyway, that aside, so when
more people work for McDonald's than work in the mining industry. Not that that's necessarily a good thing, but it does say something.
Yeah, it's just as much about the health of the country, though. But but nonetheless, when they boast how much tax they pay, which is questionable anyway, I presume they don't take off the subsidies they get back like that one we're just talking about.
No, and remember, if you think about these operations, most of the capital, the finance, comes from overseas. The mining infrastructure is largely built overseas, I mean in Korea and Asia more broadly. The labour force is relatively low because so much of it has become mechanised. I mean, we now see, trucks running around mines that are just controlled by a driver in front of a screen in an office in Perth. And most of the profits are repatriated overseas. So this is that sort of funny economics where the numbers are big, but the benefit is small.
Mm. And it's usually they pay some sort of royalty to a subsidiary of themselves and don't pay tax here on it.
And do what all multinationals have always done, which is what's called transfer pricing, which is if you've got a country which has got a certain level of taxes and another country that's got a lower level of taxes, then you will price the exchange of inputs within the company between the two countries so that the profits accrue in the country with the lower tax. I mean, which is just standard fare for all transnational companies. I mean, that's not an exception, that's just the rule.
And just on that point, I notice Angus Taylor, the favourite to get his role as Chief of Staff, is a bloke called Sam Reardon, who has been with the Australian Energy Producers, which represents Woodside, Santos, Origin and Beach Energy, and he was formerly with the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association. So he should add to the attack on climate change.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not unusual. I mean, the staff of senior MPs, I mean, we've seen this in the case of the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and his chief of staff come from or are related to or express the interest of various lobbies. In Keir Starmer's case, it was clearly the Israeli lobby. That's not an unusual thing. I mean, it might be shocking to us, but ministers' offices are full of lobbyists, not staff. I mean, really.
It's true. It's true. I mean, I what I found fascinating the other week was that it turned out there was an article about Hanson Young, the South Australian Green Senator, Sarah Hanson Young, flying her husband back and forth from Canberra, which is allowed. But it turns out he works there anyway because he's a lobbyist. But one of his clients is Rio Tinto, for God's sake.
Well, I mean, yes, and when he was a young man, he was Bob Brown's chief of staff.
That's right, he was,
And, I know him a bit, and, he does have some progressive politics, but at a certain point left the Greens and worked at the Australia Institute for quite a while and built it up to the size it is now, and then went off to set up his own lobbying firm. And as soon as you set up a lobbying firm, you have one progressive lobbyist and one conservative lobbyist. You see that with Cos Samaras and Barry in Victoria, and off you go, and you have clients on both sides. And I mean, what we're talking about here is the Canberra game, isn't it?
Yes, but the Canberra game's a dangerous one because they seem to have the numbers.
Yes.
Yeah, which brings us back to where we started. I mean, as I say, all these years later, nothing's happened. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel after all these years?
Objectively, no. I mean, I think this is one of the problems with the political system at the moment is that it will not articulate the problem as it exists. And we've seen this in the government suppressing its climate risk assessments and so on. I mean, the fact is that the rate of warming, we've reached 1.5 degrees, the rate of warming is accelerating. Fossil fuels have not yet peaked. And in fact, things like data centres are putting off the point at which they will be. There has been an energy revolution in a sense. That we know that, and it is proved and shown in practice now that renewable energy is cheaper than coal, both old coal and particularly new coal when you have to build infrastructure. So, I mean, technologically, we know what the future would look like, but it's a question of getting there.
Yeah, well, we had the situation, of course, in the December quarter where for the first time renewables provided more than half the power.
Yep.
Half the electricity, yes. And despite what industry says about, you know, being so costly, it was 44% lower than the year before, and 43% lower than the previous quarter. So I have a bit of trouble working out why it's more expensive.
Well, I mean, I would hate to be an energy analyst or expert because it seems like a very complex black hole to get into. But, I mean, it is clear that the price at which renewable generators are bidding their power into the system, that it is much cheaper than coal and, you know, 5 to 10 times cheaper than gas, which is the most expensive form of electricity. So that's not an argument. One of the problems is that we've had a electricity grid, the large-scale grid, which has connected cities to coal-fired power stations. And now we have to rebuild that grid to where renewable energy is, and those grid costs are large. I mean, it was inevitable it had to be rebuilt. But a lot of the cost associated with electricity now is not the cost of generation. It's the cost of making a grid that's suitable for the 21st century.
Yeah. And in the past week or so, the industry itself has said that the consumer should pick up that cost and not themselves.
Yes. I mean, what they want to do is, because more people have batteries and panels and are using less electricity off the grid, what they want to do is essentially double the daily charge, you know, from $1.10 or $20 to $2, between $2 and $3, which is a highly inequitable way to do it, because in those circumstances, it's not the people using the most electricity who are paying the bill, but in fact, people on lower incomes get whacked because you're paying the same amount no matter what you use and no matter what your income is. So in equity terms, what they're proposing is highly regressive and unfair.
Yeah. Because the farmers are screaming about those lines going across their property, but the Weekly Times last week, which I was down the coast and someone bought one into a house, it turns out there was an article saying, look, it's just that the government has really done a very bad job at explaining the situation and liaising with farmers, and if it did it properly, there'd be no real problem.
Yes, and I think when you look at this so-called rural opposition, you need to distinguish between a few people who are really hot under the collar, stirring up a whole lot of others, and the extent to which those people are connected to right-wing think tanks and so on. You know, I'm not convinced that the bulk of people think it's a bad idea. I mean, if they think a power line going across their property is a bad thing, they should think what an even more extreme bushfire going across their property might mean. And they might realise that the power line is the lesser evil.
Yeah, someone you know, Joel Gilmore from Griffith University. I presume you know him, do you?
Mm.
associate professor in, up there and climate councillor. He had an article recently, or a letter recently, in which, just inter alia, he says renewables are not driving power bills up. My research has shown that they are already helping to bring them down. Yep. Wholesale power prices today would be up to 50% higher without the renewables in our grid. If we want affordable, secure power, the answer is to finish modernising our energy system, not clinging to technologies already failing us. Every delay costs households more and families pay the price.
Well, I think the evidence is from the industry itself, because we've seen around Australia companies that own coal-fired stations have, to a significant extent, have voluntarily been closing them down. You know, yeah. I mean, Hazelwood was closed before its time was up, because they are simply not competitive, in the sense that they're old, they require large amounts of repair, and we're talking about, can be, you know, a couple of $100 million per generation. You've got eight units, and the cost of maintaining them would not allow them to put the power into the grid at a price which would get their money back. So the industry itself, and I mean, some of those companies that have owned large-scale generators are now building some of the biggest batteries and renewable farms as well. So I think the industry has spoken.
Yes, but Chris Bowen, you know, makes all the right noises, doesn't he, about the whole thing? And as you say, though, at the same time as he's making the noises, we're approving coal and gas all over the place.
Well, I mean, I've done a little bit of work. I've met with Minister Bowen and some of his associates and so on. I mean, and there's a really clear policy by the federal government, which I've written about, and that is, when it comes to climate change, they want to talk about clean energy all the time. Oh, we've got batteries, we've got this, we've got that, and they never want to talk about climate impacts. I mean, when they've been in power for 18 months, I did a search of all their speeches, Hansard, transcripts of press conferences and so on, and you'd find the words like, and it was to do with defence and security as well, so the words AUKUS and China and renewables and winds and energy superpower and batteries were there hundreds of times, and then you get the words like, you know, extreme fire weather, Antarctica, hardly there at all. So the government has got a really clear strategy of not talking about climate impacts, because they can't when they're expanding the fossil fuel industry. And this is how they resolve it, but by pretending that the problem isn't there.
Yeah, and as you referred to it, but AI, we've got Victoria and New South Wales competing with each other madly to attract investment in it by giving all sorts of subsidies again to these companies who are simply going to totally expand our energy use.
Well, I mean, this is shocking, and Keaton Joshi, who writes some of the best stuff of this, has been repeatedly on this for several years now. I mean, for anybody who watches the ABC television news last night, and I do partly just to watch what Alan Kohler has to say, he had a chart showing the amount of money being spent on AI infrastructure in Australia versus retail, offices and transport infrastructure. And the amount of money going into AI server farms had just popped above the other three. So more money is now going to AI than is going into public transport or offices or retail. And, I mean, what we're talking about is very large computer factories which use huge amounts of energy and huge amounts of water. And, I mean, I guess, you know, we've heard and talked about and whether we want to not engage with a thing called the cloud for, you know, 10 or 20 years, cloud computing, where information on your computer and your phone is stored off-site in the cloud. I mean, lovely idea, this cloud floating by with all your information
up there, yeah.
up there with God. But in fact, it is you know, a very large computer farm, and that has now exploded in use, partly because of artificial intelligence or what might we call machine learning. But if you look at it, the biggest the biggest demand in cloud computing, or the most energy intensive, computer intensive, are things like chatbox and image and video production. You know, those fake videos and image. I mean, they use so much power compared to processing, you know, numbers and words. And a lot of that is entirely frivolous and counterproductive and socially destructive. And I mean, I was looking to some figures, and a couple of years ago, an analyst in the US had increased his forecast of the increase in energy demand over the next 5 years in the US from 6% to 16% over those next 5 years because of computer farms. And the same thing's happening in Australia.
That's right.
I mean, the thing is that the more energy demand increases, the more difficult it is to make the energy transition work. Because in the United States, for example, the increase in demand for electricity is so great that some of the, I mean, this is the, you know, the great and the wise, the Amazons and the Metas and the Amazons and so on, are building new server factories. And they're putting in, because they can't get the power off the grid, they're putting in gas generators on the property and connecting it directly. And gas is you know, the worst way to generate electricity in terms of emissions. So not only are these AI farms mean that existing electricity generation, particularly old coal-fired power stations that are being kept operating longer in the States, but they're actually building new gas to make it worse. And Keith and Joshi, who's just done a very good report for the Australian Institute on why most of the stuff about AI is greenwashing, he wrote a thing a year ago, and I'll just read it to you. And he says, the increase in expected consumption for electricity driven by AI means the already insufficient rate of renewable energy has to steeply climb, even more than already needed. If that doesn't happen, this new data center growth will absolutely, without any question, help increase the amount of coal and gas burned in Australia's already very dirty grid. And that's the bottom line about AI.
Yeah, it's not, and it's, of course, it's not just that power use, although we've been arguing for years that the ultimate solution is to become less reliant on energy and use less rather than what we're seeing, which is a, you know, massive increase. But also, of course, there's the water factor, isn't there?
Yeah, and I mean, and there are places, because a lot of these are being built in the United States in rural areas, a much more descended population here, and towns and regions are already short of water. They're getting screwed, and the same thing will happen here. I guess we'll be building more desal plants to keep AI server farms cool.
Yeah, it's a great
irony. I mean, Kevin. I mean, I guess the other thing, which is what you've just alerted to, is this question about energy demand and the fact that, you know, energy the amount of energy that the world is using each year has been going for about 2.5% a year. A bit similar to economic growth. In the last couple of years, it's kicked up to 4% a year. And they think that that's probably the AI computer server farm need. And that means that essentially you have to replace, if it's growing by 4% a year, you would have to build 4% of the world's total energy capacity in renewables each year just to stand still. And the more energy demand grows, the more difficult it is to decarbonize. And the fact is that, 10% of the world's population is responsible for 50% of emissions. So there's a real equity issue here that people in rich countries like us don't want to talk about. The average emissions per capita around the world is 6 tons. In Australia, it's over 20 tonnes per person, and across the top 1% of the global population, it's 100 tonnes of carbon dioxide per person per year. So, I mean, if you wipe out luxury consumption, you'd probably drop global emissions by a third really quickly.
Yeah. We talk about our Pacific family, but of course we don't care about them when it comes to sending them down to the bottom of the ocean.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, the big emitters are the countries that have really high, in general, high per capita income standard of living. I mean, there's famous work being done by Oxfam and reproduced over a number of years and by others. And basically, the top 1% of people in the world produce 100 tonnes of emissions per year, and the bottom 50% produce 1.5 tonnes. 1.5 tonnes versus 100 in Australia, and in Australia we're 20. And, you know, it's they say the global travel industry, tourism industry, is about 10% of global emissions. I mean, that's hotels, but planes and ships and all that sort of thing. I mean, which is clearly a form of luxury consumption which is incompatible with the maintenance of human civilization.
Mm.
I mean, there's 10% of emissions. I mean, 7 million Australians go overseas each year. 7 million people came here. If we said, well, we'll all just stay in Australia, the Australian accommodation industry and so on would be no worse off. You'd probably have more money in Australia if nobody's travelled than the present situation. But that is a sort of an unspeakable proposition, even though it is clear that luxury consumption is the key to having a livable... Ending luxury consumption is the key to having a livable future.
And sadly, of course, also the big polluters are now using Trump's idiot philosophy to ride and go even harder.
Well, I mean, they a few years ago, banks and major corporations, the WEF and so on, these quite performative, you know, global meetings with the global elite and Richard Branson and all the cool people are there, were all promising and talking about net zero 2050, and Trump gets in and they just drop it all, and they now talk about shareholder value instead. And there was a meeting recently about the future for LNG, liquefied natural gas, which is, and all the CEOs were there, and they boldly said that currently that industry is producing 400 million tonnes of LNG a year. By 2030, they expect to be 600, and by 2050, they expect it to be 800 million tonnes. That is, I mean, whether this will come true or not, that is, they are planning to double the size of the global LNG market over the next 25 years.
Yeah, we need more and more so it can transition from itself.
Yes, but this is the madness. I mean, I think it's becoming increasingly obvious that, I mean, you talk to scientists or people on the street and they know that, you know, bad shit's coming. I mean, in England and Ireland, they've had these floods for 3 months over winter. It has to stop raining. All the crops have been wiped out. You go to a public meeting and say, stick up your hand if you think your grandkids will have a better way of life than you did, and not a person in the room will stick their hand up. I mean, people know what's coming, but in the West in particular, governments are, I think, structurally incapable of dealing with the problem.
Yeah, we've only got a minute left, David, but what, well, I mean, that's a negative note, but what can we do?
The really big issue is Australia is a petrostate. We're exporting huge amounts of coal and gas, and that's got to be the key issue. And these new export licences are just a death sentence for people's grandchildren. And I know that Adam Banse just become the CEO of ACF, and he's talking about mobilising people and getting them back on the street. And I think we need to spend less time in Canberra and more time in collective action.
Yeah, well, that's a positive note at least to end on, which is unusual in this program.
he says he's going to transform the ACF into a campaigning organisation.
Yeah, let's hope so.
That style, and let's hope so, because that's absolutely the right way to be going.
Yeah, a few of us were talking about that just this week. In fact, about we hope he will change them and get them much more active. Yeah.
Yeah, might be trying to turn the Titanic around, but we'll see.
Okay. David, look, we'll talk again, but thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Devin.
Okay. David Spratt there, who, as you can tell, is a expert on the subject, and but not that optimistic, unfortunately. And Koshin, thanks very much for your time this morning. You could have joined in there, by the way, if you wanted to.
No, I was happy to observe. No, very interesting. It's great.
Okay, righty. Well, thanks for that. And next week, we're back to the first Wednesday of the month. So it's Transport next week with John McPherson. And that's it. But Koshin, thanks for keeping us on air.
No worries. Thanks so much.
Okay.